Welcome to Independence, the FIUC podcast. My name's Phil Topham, Executive Director of the FIUC, and it's time for our dive into the news that's been going on this last couple of weeks. And with me, two men whose betting activity has been looked at for giving away the dates of the 2026 Leaders Conference. Any comments?
It's under investigation at the moment. I can't possibly comment.
Excellent. John Stevens, our National Director, say hello, John.
Hi, Phil.
And that was our Head of National Ministries, Adrian Reynolds. Good morning, Adrian.
You should point out that was a joke.
That was a joke, of course. Yes, well, it was a joke. It is just a brilliant joke because it is so contemporaneous.
Yes.
So there we are. Yeah. Excellent. Brothers, what have you been up to this week? We've had our last local conferences, haven't we? I think you've both been to various ones.
I've been in Liverpool. We've both been in Liverpool.
We both went to Liverpool.
Good group there, 50 people meeting together. Daniel Grimwade, who's not our director for Liverpool, but is close by, crossed the Pennines.
Yorkshire's
and led
quite
the day.
A long way from Liverpool, just geographically.
Well,
yeah.
Anyway, he led the day very well, and just a great time, really. Same sort of stories that are happening. I mean, not every church can report exactly the same thing at the same level, but it was just encouraging to hear from local churches. In some ways, I mean, because I've done the day so many times, it kind of felt familiar, but that was the new bit for me. And it was encouraging to hear, again, stories of conversions, stories of people turning up, stories of churches becoming more diverse. You know, all the challenges that go along with that, but actually great joy. One really standout story was a schools worker who's based in Bethel Church in Liverpool, just reporting how, you know, a patient investment in schools is really paying off. He's now the lay chaplain at a Church of England school. And he's gone from, you know, a few years ago when they were saying, don't mention Jesus, to people actually welcoming him in, bringing Bibles and being really grateful that he's providing spiritual care to the kids and input.
So that's just extraordinary.
There are
it?
Some yeah. remarkable opportunities. Incredible. I think we're very negative about the opportunities, and especially we hear horror stories about schools and churches who rent school buildings falling out with their schools because of their position on same-sex marriage. And all of that's very painful, of course, and very real. But amongst all of that, there are these glorious opportunities, and the Lord is doing something. So, yeah, thrilling to hear that.
I think that's right. And I think, you know, we've had 29 conferences around the country and met with a lot of leaders through that. And it really does give you the opportunity to get a feel for what's happening on the ground. And I think when you talk to a lot of people, you do tend to get this consistent story, which has been wonderfully encouraging. So that was true in Liverpool as well. The numbers of leaders I spoke to who were saying new people are coming to church. Again, multiple stories of people have turned up at church. Somebody was saying a 14-year-old girl just turned up at church and then came to the kind of the youth group. Baptisms and conversions. There was one pastor I was talking to. They've got 7 baptisms this sort of Sunday. Another leader of the church says they've had 15 so far kind of this year. I asked him, what are you doing differently? Why are people coming in? He said, we're not doing anything differently.
Yeah.
And I think that's actually a story repeated in a lot of places.
And that's important to reflect on that, isn't it? Because I think, you know, we can get so wound up in terms of, well, if only I did this, if only I did that, things would happen. Or in fact, in churches when very little is happening, getting demoralized because we think I'm not doing the right thing. What else could I be doing? So it's actually good to be reminded, isn't it, John, that actually it's the regular ministry of the church.
And Liverpool and the Northwest and Wirral have been a really encouraging area for FIEC, certainly over the time that I've been an FIEC kind of national director. So it was great to meet some guys there from churches that have joined FIEC. So there was a church from a Brethren background, a church from a Grace Baptist background, both have joined FIEC in the last few years. But kind of great to see them engaging. So one of those churches now helping another church to be revitalized. There are some great stories of church planting and revitalization across kind of Liverpool and kind of the Wirral. I mean, Christchurch Liverpool and Cornerstone have both got involved with other churches and sent groups of people to them. I was speaking to a guy who'd been sent to revitalize a church with a group from a church in a sort of a deprived community. And then I got 30 or 40 people coming along and others coming in from the community. The real kind of inter-cooperation between the churches in kind of Liverpool and that working together, which is what we want FIEC to be all about, is just very tangible on the ground. And it's thrilling to see that working out.
Yeah, we also had conferences this week in Sussex and Loo and in Kendal up in Cumbria. So these have come to an end now, but have been a great encouragement as we've considered that this wonderful justification by faith.
Some people have been asking, will the videos that were used in the conference be made available? And the answer to that is we will make them available. We were waiting until the end of the conferences. But so if you've been to one of those conferences and you've seen that Glyn Harrison video and thought, that's really useful, we will make that available.
So I mean, I had a conversation with one pastor's wife when we were just talking about what's happening in the churches and what they're seeing. She described it as it feels like low-level revival. revival, which I think is actually quite a good way of describing what's happening.
Given what's happened previously, yeah, you mean, that's how it feels. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Actually, you know, the fact that local church leaders are seeing that and saying that is really something I think that ought to encourage us. And I think it means we ought to be giving thanks for what God is doing. I personally think this is the most encouraging period I've seen in 35 years of being a Christian in terms of on the ground gospel kind of growth. And I think we need to basically just recognize that we're in that moment, be thankful for it, make the most of it, support and encourage one another. That just seems to be where we're at.
I do think it's worth reflecting that what we are seeing does bring its own leadership challenges. So I think we sometimes sort of go along in church feeling it all feels a bit moribund, and we think, well, if only people were saved, if only people were converted, you know, everything would be fine. And actually, the reality is leadership is always challenging. There are always things to wrestle with and things to give your time to. It's just that they're different. So I think what people are saying is, you know, one of the things we're wrestling with is, you know, how do we lead a more diverse church? How do we lead a church where lots of people are very, very new believers, or perhaps have come in from other churches, they're very poorly taught, they need to be discipled? So there are other challenges of leadership. So of course there is great joy, and I don't want to diminish that in any way at all, but we just need to recognize that there are challenges ahead and we need to be prepared for them.
And one of the ways we can prepare people is with the leaders conference coming up in November, which is all about shepherding, isn't it? And Brian Croft coming over from the States to help us think about that. So this is the last week to get your tickets at the early bird price. I think it's the 29th of June, I think, is the last day to get your early bird ticket. So do feel free to do that. You'll save lots of money on your ticket, and you can join us in early November.
And the after conference event is also open for bookings. We've got a limited number of places for that. Got 100 places for that, and they are filling up. So if you're interested in that, do please book in for
that. So that's 24 hours after the conference, Trusted Hands event with Brian Croft, which is an additional cost to the main conference.
It's about the raising up and training and deploying of volunteer workers, lay workers, leaders in the church.
Excellent. That's taking place for 24 hours after the main conference. 7 minutes in, and we've not even got to the news yet. It's so much good stuff going on.
Phil, that is all news.
Yeah. Oh, no, yeah, I don't disagree. But in terms of what's happening, there's an election on, gentlemen, in case it had missed your attention. Extraordinary election campaign, really. I say that because it feels a bit like in football, balling terms, one team's 6-0 up with 15 minutes to go, and you wish the referee would blow his whistle. Now, I'm sure there's still lots to decide, but it does look like we're heading for a new government, a massive Labour majority and landslide. And lots been said about that in the news this last couple of weeks. Would that be healthy? Would that not be healthy? All sorts of reasons for that we might get into. Yeah. But it does feel like, unless Sir Keir Starmer does something monumentally stupid in the next couple of weeks, that is where it's going to go.
I mean, the polls all seem to indicate that, don't they? Yeah. We need to be just a tiny bit cautious about polls, not least because our voting system, the way the polls work, they don't always go constituency by constituency, although some of the recent ones have. And our voting system, which is first past the post system, means that actually you can win quite a large proportion of the vote and get no seats.
Yeah, indeed.
Or you can have a fairly small proportion of the vote and win many seats. Mm. So there are some kind of vagaries of each individual constituency and how it works. And so, for example, just because a party like Reform is scoring very highly in the polls,
they're unlikely to get lots of MPs.
I mean, it still looks like they're probably going to get one.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe one or two more, and maybe not even one.
So same for the Greens as well. Exactly. In a similar place, aren't they?
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
So all of those cautions aside, it does look like it's going to be a change in government. People have still got 2 weeks, just under 2 weeks now to make up their mind. I've actually voted already.
Because you're on holiday.
I'm on holiday. Yeah, so I got a postal vote and I've looked into it carefully, prayed about it, considered it. And I'm not going to tell you who I voted for, but I didn't find it an easy decision. I think a lot of the issues that I feel strongly about, I don't find a party that feels strongly about all the issues that I feel about. I find myself holding my nose with every party. And so actually, I think, as we've talked about before, we've recorded a little podcast with Christian Institute, which you can see online.
That'll be in the show notes, yeah.
You do have to make kind of sort of judgments about trading off one thing against another, which is not easy. Not everybody's going to come to the same conclusion on that. So I have wrestled with that, but I have voted. So I watched the debate last night. One of my friends was in the audience, so we were basically playing spot the friend. But I was able to watch it, actually, because it was the same old things being kind of rehearsed, wasn't it? It's the same old stuff over and over again, sound bites and what have you. So I did actually feel a sense of relief.
John, what lessons could leaders learn from perhaps somebody coming into government with a massive majority. Are there lessons for church life there? If one group is dominating, how do we make sure all views are heard and represented?
Yeah, well, there's no doubt giving a massive landslide victory gives immense power to those who come into office. It's not unprecedented. I mean, in some ways, this is not unlike 1997, where there's clearly a shift to the kind of Labour, and Tony Blair wins with a very big majority in that election. It's not unlike 1983, when Margaret Thatcher won and defeated Labour under a kind of Michael Foot, and again had a very significant...
45 was quite a big majority.
45 was quite a big majority as well for Labour after the Second World War, unexpectedly then,
I think, at that particular point.
So it's not unprecedented. And obviously under the British system, if you have a significant parliamentary majority, you are basically able to push through whatever legislation you want. It comes with immense power. We have the principle of ultimately the sovereignty of Parliament. And at one level, Parliament is free to do whatever it wants to do. And part of the Brexit debate was people wanting Parliament to have that kind of authority sort of again. Of course, it depends upon the government and MPs as to whether they exercise that power responsibly. So a first kind of lesson is just the importance of how you see power and what you seek to use it for. So at one level, you can come into office and you think we are the masters now, and it's our opportunity to be able to kind of do what we want and impose our will on everybody else. Or you can think we've been given great power and we are the servants now. How can we serve others and serve what is best? It's worth recognizing there are constraints on what even Parliament can do and what the Commons can do. So we don't quite have a written constitution, but we have two houses of Parliament. So the House of Lords there is a scrutinising group. Labour doesn't have a majority in the House of Lords in the way that it will probably have in the House of Commons. And actually, the way that it works is the House of Lords should support what's in the Labour manifesto. But of course, relatively little is set out in detail in the manifesto. And then on those other issues, the House of Commons has the right to operate as a revising chamber. At the same time, the courts have a role in holding government and the executive to account. And governments find that very frustrating, that kind of judicial review can reach the conclusion that decisions were made unlawfully or without adequate consultation. But that's actually a very important protection against the abuse of power. And more widely than that, actually some of the human rights and constitutional provisions, European Convention on Human Rights brought into British law in the Equalities Acts, lays down some fundamental rights that individuals have against government, which again, the courts are entitled to enforce. So it's quite nuanced. It gives a lot of power, but there are those checks and balances. And again, in church life, in churches, although you might have a very large majority of people hold one view, actually church constitutions, their rules are very important to hold people to account, that they, in a sense, keep to the doctrinal position. They make decisions in the appropriate and the right way. So unchecked power is, I think, potentially dangerous, particularly if, depending on the character of the person who is exercising it. And in church life, again, you want to be able to be sort of leading the church for the benefit of all people and recognize that there is a diversity. Actually, church, there's a stronger emphasis on wanting to build the unity of the body and serve the common good than there is in politics, which is more kind of adversarial between kind of different groups. So I think how those who have significant power, however it's given to them, sort of handle that power is a really crucial question. And that comes down to character. It will be a test of Keir Starmer, a test of his ministers, a test of his MPs as to how they handle something that gives them so much power, and whether they use that with wisdom and restraint or whether they use that selfishly and oppressively.
There's another lesson there as well, I think, Phil, which is about those who elect people into power. I've watched all the debates, and I found them pretty depressing. Not least because just how angry people are. Yeah. People are very, very angry with everybody, and it ends up being quite unbecoming. And I understand people have been through some very difficult things, and obviously they choose questioners with. You know, it's always people with personal stories, isn't it? You know, someone that's not going to ask a question about the NHS is someone who's just been through treatment and so on. So I can understand that people feel strongly about stuff, but I think there's a way to conduct yourself. As Christians, as we think about our churches, most of which are congregational in the way that they're electing people, not all of them, but most of them, the way they're electing leaders, there is a way to conduct yourself. There is a way to behave, filled with the fruit of the Spirit, which I think is entirely different. And also with the interests of others at heart. So I think the other thing that's really struck me about the debate last night, for example, is people asking questions like, and I'm just kind of paraphrasing here, well, this policy doesn't apply to me, this policy doesn't apply to me, what are you going to do for me? Mm. And I think it's a shame that the election has come down to, and very often is seen as, you choose the person who's going to do best for you. Mm-hmm. So it seems to be very difficult for people to think what's best for the country or what's best for my neighbour. Yeah. And actually, church life is entirely different from that. And we've got to make sure that kind of, you know, what's in it for me ethos doesn't seep into church life. We're there to bless others. Mm. You know, we're there to seek the good of others before ourselves. All these are very, very strong biblical principles. And that's got to run through church life.
So it's another comment, Mr. Power, I think another factor that's sort of relevant is that actually the constraint on the use of the power is the fact that whoever is in the government will know they will have to face the electorate again in the future. I mean, back in 2019, when Boris Johnson won his massive majority, everybody was saying politics had been rewritten, the red wall had come over to the Conservatives, Labour would be out of power for a generation, and here we are. In the end, there is an ultimate accountability to the people that you serve. And actually, there's a measure to which that's true for church leaders as well. You know, it may not be quite as formalized in congregational churches. It is probably more strongly seen as an accountability to the congregation. But leaders are both accountable to God, but there is also an accountability to the people they lead. And in the end, leadership will never be successful if you lose the consent of those that you're leading. I think that's why in the Bible, when it talks about appointing elders, the language can also mean electing. I think there is a sense in which the body as a whole decides who meets the criteria and who it trusts to be the leaders. So there's a right and proper accountability to those who are being led, that actually their consent, their support is necessary. And actually, when church leaders lose that, actually it becomes very difficult in church life. And in the end, most leaders cannot sustain their position in the long run.
I don't particularly, you might disagree with me, but I don't particularly want to drive a wedge between accountability to God and accountability to the congregation. Because I think that's actually how accountability to God is largely mediated. It's through the congregation, if you are congregational. So I think there's a, I understand what you're saying, but I think I want to feel quite strongly that I don't want to say a leader is both accountable to God and to the congregation. I think those two things are, there's a Venn diagram there with a large intersection in the middle.
Oh, we completely agree about that, because I think actually 1 Corinthians, the body has the mind of Christ. And actually,
just filling out my resignation letter.
Actually, the crucial thing here in church, in congregationalism, is the congregation is not simply deciding, do I like that person? It's not a popularity contest. It shouldn't be, am I getting all that
That's
I want?
That's exactly right.
Basically, it should be about discerning whether this is a person who is leading well under God and is right for this congregation. Actually, it's never been the case that congregationalism was meant to be exercising your vote for personal preference. It's meant to be judging what is spiritually right before God, prayerfully and carefully. So I think we're probably agreed.
Who does Jesus want as your leader? That's what you're voting for.
Yeah, we do again. Well, next time we record this podcast in the news will be probably the day after the election, and all will become clear.
Won't be here, I'm sorry.
We'll have to find a super sub who can come in and help us on the 5th of July. But yes, we will prayerfully consider who we will vote for, and we will see what transpires. It's worth saying, if you want some help to think about how you can talk about the election in your church, Edward Connor solicitors have put out a really helpful article this week, which we'll link to in the show notes. John, you have something else to pick up?
You're absolutely right. We need to preferably think about who we vote. Actually, the Bible tells us we should pray for whoever wins, that actually whoever is in government, whoever has that power, they are the ones that we are to also particularly pray for, that they would exercise that power in a right way to serve more widely. So we are to pray that we would kind of, in a sense, continue to be able to live quiet lives.
Make that the theme of your prayer meeting, first prayer meeting after July 4th.
So I think our reaction shouldn't be we won or we lost. Our reaction should be, let's pray for who God has put in that position, that they would serve well and with due accountability.
Excellent. Amen to that. Let's talk about a story that you picked up, John, this week about the Church of Scotland. So the Church of Scotland is selling 100 buildings. 85% of Scottish weddings now don't take place in a church building. The decline of Christianity in Scotland, I know if our Scotland director, Andy Hunter was here, he'd say the same. You know, it's been dramatic and swift.
He's written a little article on the website. We'll put the link in.
Yes, he did a couple of weeks ago, didn't he? About sort of church tenants in Scotland and the like. But this is an extraordinary story, isn't it? Because all of these buildings now on the market, because essentially there's no one to worship in them anymore.
It is an extraordinary story, but of course it's not a new story. And actually in Scotland, in some ways, religion in civic and public life lasted longer than it did in, for example, England. But secularism has now swept through Scotland very rapidly. But you could walk around almost any English town and you could see kind of... particularly churches, chapels that have been turned into restaurants, cafes, carpet warehouses, mosques. Yeah. Actually, this is part of the
FIEC churches.
Yeah.
In one or two rare occasions.
This is part of the kind of essential decline of civic Christianity in the UK, which has actually been going on since 1858. So 1858 was the high point of church going in the nation. And since then, there has been, in a sense, decline, not always at the same pace, with some kind of moments at which there's been a bit of a reverse after the Second World War. But basically, that's been the general picture. But I think it shows the sort of desperate situation that the Church of Scotland is in as an established church. Congregations are dying. People are not turning to the church. They're becoming kind of elderly. And effectively, assets are having to be sold off to continue to bankroll.
That's a different strategy to the Church of England, though, isn't it, John? So in the Church of England,
they're not selling buildings.
Similar catastrophic decline, but there isn't this. I mean, there are one or two buildings being sold, but there's not the same sale of buildings, is there?
Well, there are redundant churches in the Church of England that are being made available. Lots of the kind of Victorian buildings that were built in urban areas, because parishes are being rationalised and unattractive buildings are being sold off. Actually, you can't really do that with your medieval parish churches in
Grade
village areas.
You can't even take the pews out, as we've discovered this week.
I mean, in the Church of England, it's a slightly different situation, because they have literally billions of pounds that are held by the church commissioners that basically bankroll the ministry. And of course, I think, I would want to say, these groups that are declining, the established churches, it's largely because they've abandoned the gospel or they're not consistently preaching the gospel. We say there are faithful evangelical churches within both the Church of Scotland and the Church of England, but they're a small minority. But basically, for the last 150 years, liberalism has basically said, we don't believe Christianity. Actually, social action, social worker there. And of course, people have then believed them and thought, well, why on earth do we need to bother with church? We can do all of those things. We can care for the environment, care for the poor, care for our communities without the need to turn up to church on a Sunday and give and invest in this added element of kind of life. And in the end, it's not surprising. Denominations like the Methodists, URC, that don't have those vast historic resources, they're closing buildings, but they have nothing to keep it going. So actually, an edifice of buildings and the performance of services is able to be maintained long after the people have gone. And that is a tragedy that I think the church it hasn't really faced up to. And it won't quite admit the real reasons for it. The other side of the story, of course, is that evangelical churches are growing. So this is the decline of a section of the church, because it's utterly failed to meet the spiritual needs of the people. The contrast is that actually God's faithful people have got on with it, often outside of those structures, starting new churches, buying new buildings, meeting in hired premises, and the church there is growing.
There may be opportunities for FIC churches.
Yeah, that question.
And there are one or two FIC churches already that meet in buildings they've bought from other denominations when they were going to be closed. And especially if they are listed and there are restrictions on them, to continue them as places of worship can be straightforward. It's not always straightforward. Anecdotally, one pastor told me in a northern town, he phoned up the local Methodist superintendent and said, "You haven't got any buildings for sale, have you?" And the guy said, "I've got 8." So, you know, there are opportunities, but it's not always straightforward. Often denominations don't want to sell to other denominations and so on. But there may be an opportunity where you live in terms of buildings.
I mean, change of use is right, isn't it? Because obviously that's going to be a big problem for somebody wanting to turn a church into something else. But if you're going in to keep it going as a place of worship, that's one hurdle you don't have to get across, I guess.
And as evangelicals, we mustn't have a kind of a schadenfreude about that. As we see kind of groups kind of declining and struggling, we ought to be grieved, because at one level they still take the name of Christ, and they have an impact on the public witness of
the
gospel.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there are evangelical churches that have struggled and declined and closed. So,
So I think we might recognize reasons why it's happening. The response to that is to pray that God would bring repentance and renewal, that people would recognize the reality of why that has happened. And our longing and prayer is that God would be at work again, kind of in the nation. So it's not any joy in watching that happen. In fact, actually, it's a great sadness.
So speaking of reconciliation, let's talk about Rory McIlroy. This is a really interesting story. It's one you picked up this last couple of weeks, Adrian. So golfer Rory McIlroy was going to divorce his wife. They spent some time meeting with one another. And then they changed their mind and were reconciled.
Well, he served her divorce papers
so it got very
in
far,
the middle of a tournament.
Yeah. But from what I've read, they sat down together and they reconciled their differences to stay married.
We don't know what's going on behind the scenes, do we? And actually, at the US Open last week, USPGA, Rory McIlroy had a bit of a meltdown in the last round. He was doing well, could have won. It all went a bit pear-shaped. He stormed off at the end. Who knows what's going on in his life?
But a personal life win, it would seem, even if a professional
It looks like it,
loss,
doesn't it? I mean, he's taking time away from golf, so let's hope that's helpful for him. I think it is worth recognising that there are certain professions, and it's not just elite sports people. There are certain professions which cause husbands and wives to spend a long time away from each other. That's very, very difficult for marriage. Mm. So if you serve in the armed services, for example, if you're away in the Navy, if you're off on a submarine where you can't even have contact, you spend long, long periods away from a spouse. And you may have people in your church who are in that situation. Mm. You may have people in your church who have come to the UK to work. Perhaps there isn't a spousal visa available. So people might be studying in the UK, for example, and spending, I've taught people at college who have spent 6 months away from their family and their spouse. And it's worth recognizing that puts an immense strain on marriages. So you may not have a Rory McIlroy in your congregation, but you may have people in this situation. Mm. Need to treat them with great kindness and help and support and make sure they're getting all the spiritual and the functional help that they need. But it is a good story. Yeah. I loved it when I read it. I thought, actually, so often you hear about, occasionally hear about long lasting celebrity marriages. I always rejoice in that because marriage is a great institution. And when you hear about long lasting marriages, you read an obituary and you discover someone's been married for 60 years or something. Mm. That's nice to hear.
70 for my grandparents at the beginning of July.
Well done them. Well done them. And I think we ought to celebrate long marriages. Mm. I know that's painful for people who haven't, have had trouble in marriage, but actually there's something about keeping a marriage going, which is a remarkable instance of grace and in the world of common grace, I think. But yes, in this particular situation, to see reconciliation, it sounds like, you've served someone divorce papers, you sent the lawyer around, that's it. There's no way back from that. But even in this situation, there does seem to have been a way back. And I think it does give us hope. It gives us hope in churches when relationships break down. It gives us hope in our pastoral ministry when we're working with couples when there seem to be intractable problems. I think, if this is true in the world, how much more so in the church when we can bring the gospel to bear. So I found it a really hopeful story. It made me smile.
It's interesting. Speaking of long marriages, just let me throw this one in. I was chatting to somebody earlier in the week who was saying, what is the secret to a long marriage? It was a couple who'd been married for decades. And they said, well, back when we first got married, we fixed everything. We fixed our jumpers. We fixed all the things that went wrong in the house. We fixed them. We didn't throw them away and buy new ones. And their comment was, we think that's what's happened with marriage in the modern day. When it breaks, you don't try and fix it. You just throw it away and get a new one. I thought that was an interesting comment. Yeah, John.
Ronnie Barkey says the secret to long marriage is separate bathrooms.
It is a wonderful gospel picture, isn't it, really? At one level, the Bible tells us that marriage is fundamentally the relationship that pictures the relationship That's between right. God and his people. And there is something wonderful about when marriage relationships are saved in that way. So deciding not to divorce. I've been in churches, many of us have been in churches, there might have been marriages that have recovered after adultery or unfaithfulness. And in a sense, that is a remarkable triumph of the gospel, that there was sort of forgiveness and sort of restoration and reconciliation. Incredibly costly, but actually in some ways that pictures what the gospel is all about. I've been in a church where there was a couple who'd been married for a long time, they got divorced. Actually, some years later, they even remarried just because they realised that they would want to come back together. That's a glorious in many ways, that's exactly what the Bible says about God. Yeah. In the Old Testament, God serves divorce papers on his people because of their adultery.
Yeah, that's right.
But he doesn't take another wife. In effect, he takes them back as his wife. Yeah, just read the book of Hosea as the most extraordinary picture of God's grace towards his unfaithful spouse, his kind of people who has entered into prostitution, but is then sought out and brought back. Mm. And we need to just remember that's what the gospel is all about. And I think sometimes we as Christians, you're right about fixing marriage and keeping marriage and long marriages. We can kind of put the emphasis on a kind of a legalistic making it appear to work and lose sight of the power of mending that which is broken. Mm-hmm. And the gospel is basically all about mending what is broken, because in the end, we're all broken. in our relationships, and that is possible ultimately through Christ is just the great news of the gospel.
Fantastic. Last couple of minutes, let's talk about Alan Bates getting a knighthood. So we've talked a lot about the post office scandal on this podcast over recent months, but this is a wonderful story of a man who's fought for justice in this arena, and then in the King's birthday honours list, he is going to become Sir Alan Bates. And I think that's well deserved. And there's a really interesting picture there, isn't there, about somebody who has faithfully proclaimed truth and then is rewarded for it.
Yes, and faithfully proclaimed truth against the odds. Mm. He hasn't just been standing up and speaking up for truth. Actually, it's been a battle and really worn him down and had a profound effect on his relationships and on his work and all sorts of things. So I think for that reason, he's been extraordinarily tenacious. If you haven't seen the ITV drama, Mr. Bates in the Post Office, I do recommend you watch
it's great
it. I think it's excellent.
Yeah.
And obviously some things are, dramatised. But I do think it just tells an excellent story of a pursuit for justice. And interestingly, he wasn't prepared to take this crown, if you like, this reward and this acknowledgement until Paula Venables had given hers back, mm-hmm. because he sort of saw somehow that it demeaned it. And, I think it's a great story that's just out in the world. But it is a reminder that actually there is a judge who sees all, mm-hmm. and there is a judge who will reward. And, everything will be laid bare. And I think in some ways that's both a great comfort when things go wrong, but it's also a great encouragement just to keep pursuing things that are right, even when people's eyes aren't on you. Mm-hmm. Obviously, this has been a very public thing, although only really recently it's been very, very public, but it has been in the public eye. But there are other things. There are other people who are campaigning for very noble causes. They don't get mentioned. They don't get seen. And sometimes perhaps must think, is it worth it? Do I keep pursuing it? Well, the Lord sees. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a great call to keep pursuing the Christian life and everything that the Lord calls us to.
Mm. I think that's what I mean. Again, it's just a little glimpse of the gospel, isn't
Absolutely.
It? Really
yeah,
wonderful. You kind of think, actually, Alan Bates was...
There's a reason we pick these stories, John. Yeah. It's a glimpse of the gospel.
He was falsely accused, convicted, kind of shamed publicly, in a sense, and ultimately he's been vindicated. Yeah. And having been vindicated, he is now honoured. And at one level, that's the story of Jesus, isn't
Absolutely.
It? Sort of the cross is the wrongful conviction of Jesus as the one who's put to death for sin, but he is vindicated by his resurrection and he is exalted and honoured to the right hand of God. So you kind of think, actually, there's just a parallel there. Mm-hmm. And just reminds us that is at the very heart of the gospel story. There's a rightness to it. Mm-hmm. I think that's the point. We see the Alan Bates story, we think there's a rightness to that, and it helps us see there is a rightness to the gospel. Yeah. And I think it does remind us as Christians that is actually true for us as well. In this world, we expect that we will be falsely accused, that we will be shamed, that we will not be honoured and rewarded as we should be. But yet the ultimate judge sees and will reward and will honour those who have been his faithful servants. No matter what the world's thought of them and how it's characterised them, criminals or whatever, actually they will ultimately be honoured. And I think that's really important. I mean, we were thinking in our senior leadership team not too long ago of the parable of the persistent widow who kind of seemed not to get justice but kept crying to the judge justice, and the unjust judge is eventually willing because he's fed up with her coming. And actually the whole point is God's not like that judge, but he will do justice for his people. But often we have to wait patiently and keep crying for that justice to be done. Yeah. But it will, in the end, be done.
He hasn't got his money yet. So interestingly, he has been given a knighthood, but he's not been given a compensation package to...
He's not agreed to it.
He's not agreed to it. Yeah. Which is a reminder, actually, that there is an imperfection in this kind of reward. And actually what Christians are hoping for is a great and perfect reward. And actually great riches that await. We do believe in a kind of prosperity gospel, not in this life, but immense riches as we reign with Christ, if indeed we share in his suffering.
And I think in a fallen world, justice isn't always perfectly done. That's a reality. Yeah. But we must rejoice when there are instances when justice really is done, because that actually points us to the fact that actually that is the way things are meant to be. And it's a reminder to us that that's what will be done.
Preach it, brother.
Well done, brothers. Good to chat about what's going on in the news. Adrian, enjoy your holiday when it comes in a couple of weeks. This has been In the News, Independence, the FIEC podcast. If you've enjoyed it, do rate and leave a review. And we'll look forward to talking with you again soon. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Phil.